Primordial Soup Pot. I'm Rustin, and I'm here with my co-host.
Hi, I'm Aaron.
Every couple of weeks, Aaron and I get together to talk about some new topic or theme within the world of ecology, evolution, and natural history. And if you were listening last time, you know we're talking about ponds this time.
Yep, good old-fashioned ponds. It should be a staple of everyone's childhood. You know, going down, catching tadpoles, fishing for largemouth. At my elementary school, we had something called outdoor school. And it's just like for a week, you get to go in the woods for a little bit. And it was the coolest bit when you went to the ponds.
Okay. So we called that outdoor ed, but same kind of thing. Same deal.
Yeah.
You were sleeping in cabins for a week.
Yep. That was
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We did the same kind of thing. Didn't do any pond stuff, though.
Oh, it was only one day. It was a fun day, though. Yeah, actually, it was only like an hour. You just go down, you see what you could catch in a net.
I wish we had done pond stuff. That would have been fun. Instead, we did orienteering.
What is orienteering?
Basically, you use a series of directions and like coordinates and stuff to find various different landmarks. Kind of like a guided tour or scavenger hunt thing. At least for a middle schooler, it was really, really boring. So I think we got about three or four directions in, and it took us about a half hour to get through all those. And like the instructors realized that we weren't going to finish. And they were like, all right, you guys can just go do whatever.
Oh, that's sad.
We're like, this is really boring. Can we do something else? And they're like, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Well, you did in middle school, right?
Yeah.
That's why. That's when the love of nature just kind of seeps away from your body.
Yeah.
Kids love nature. Like, when I was a kid, everyone did. I don't know. Something in the water. They just stopped. Yeah. Once they get older, they don't want to go outside anymore.
I think once you're in middle school, hormones start raging and you start caring about what other people think of you. And you realize that it's not attractive to walk into a building covered in mud and pond scum. And so that's kind of when you stop thinking nature is as cool. You know,
you can shower. You're allowed to shower, too. The two are not mutually exclusive.
Right, except that when you're a teenager, you have that, like, sense of hyper-embarrassment that comes along with that age. So when you get that, when you're that, like, unappealing because of whatever you've been doing, you don't think that it's something, that's something perfectly natural that you can just go wash off. You're like, oh my gosh, if anyone sees me like this, I'll die, you know?
Well, it's not just that. Another thing is bugs. Like, most young kids don't, at least from what I've seen, they're not afraid of bugs. Like, they see a bug, it's like, oh, look, a bug. But I don't know, like, something when you get older, like, the fear of bugs increases.
Yeah, I can't really explain that one. I don't think you can either, because you never became afraid of bugs.
Yeah, there's some bugs I don't like. I'm not going to go playing with a yellow jacket.
Sure. And there are birds that I don't like, too. But all I'm saying is that in that particular aspect, you're much more childlike than most other people.
Oh, well, gee, thanks.
It's a compliment. You've managed
I'm
to
in
hold
the third
on
grade, but I read on a fifth grade level.
No. You've managed to hold on to your childlike innocence. It's a very enviable quality.
Well, let's get into the actual topic of today. Rustin, what do you have for me?
All right. So when people think of ponds, they often think of an algae-covered, smelly pool that's surrounded by some kind of cattail-like vegetation. And, of course, being near a pond can be very unpleasant for reasons beyond just the smell. That being the near omnipresence of biting insects, mosquitoes in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I personally associate being near stagnant water with being very itchy afterward from all the bug bites that I've acquired. However, this particular line of thinking led me to a really interesting topic because, as it turns out, there is a natural method that people have been using to try and control runaway mosquito populations in ponds. This is with a species of small fish, and it is known as the mosquito fish.
It's aptly named.
Which is, yes, a very creative name, I know. Have you heard of these at all?
Have I heard of mosquito fish? Yeah, I've heard of mosquito fish. I have some in a fish tank right now.
Of course you do.
It's supposed to be a native bay tank. I don't think they're actually native to Maryland, but they're in Maryland.
No, they're not. I can get into that. How much do you know about their native range and their impacts?
I know that they're basically like a guppy, and I know that they're widespread. I don't actually know where they're from, though.
Okay, all right. So most of this will be new for you, at least based on the sound of it. We'll see. If you know anything else, just feel free to chime in here. It is worth noting that when people talk about mosquito fish, they're actually talking about two separate species, which are Gambusa affinis and Gambusa holbrooki. I think I pronounced that correctly. Mm-hmm. For the purposes of this piece, I'm going to discuss them as one group because they are very similar in terms of the niches that they occupy and even in terms of their appearance. The distinction between the two species wasn't even recognized until about 30 or 40 years ago. Mm. And this means that both species of mosquito fish were introduced by people regardless of the difference between the species. People thought they were just all one group. So they were treated that way. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about in this piece. So I'll just do the same. To be fair, the difference between these two species is very slight. You have to count the rays on the dorsal and the anal fins to distinguish one from the other. Anyway, so mosquito fish.
I mean, it's not like at the top of my list.
No, no.
You think someone was just sort of like dicking around one day? He's like, yeah, I'll count the rays on the anal fins. He's like, oh my God, guys, you got to come see this.
Honestly, it kind of sounds like the kind of task they gave to like some down on their luck grad or undergrad student, you know, like he had fucked up something in the lab and they're like, all right, go count all the rays on the mosquito fish. You're in timeout, you know.
Hey, joke's on them.
Right. And then they
groundbreaking discovery.
Guess what? They're two separate species.
And his last name was Holbrooki. Maybe. I don't know.
It could have been.
It honestly could have been.
I wouldn't be surprised. Anyway, so like you mentioned, mosquito fish are a small minnow or guppy-like fish that only grow to be about a few inches long. They're originally native to the southeastern United States, to answer your question, particularly the Mississippi River Basin. So Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, up into Tennessee and Arkansas, as far north as Illinois, although they don't get too much further north than that, in their native range. In terms of their appearance, they're kind of a gray-brown in color and generally pretty dull-looking. They do have this upturned mouth, which helps them feed on things near the surface. Female mosquito fish also give birth to live young, which will reach maturity in a few months. But this process can be slowed at lower temperatures and expedited at higher temperatures, depending on their environment. Their clutch sizes are also highly variable, too, and they can be as small as one egg or as large as 375 eggs. So very, very high reproductive capacity with this species.
In one go.
Yeah. They can really pop out those kids.
Yeah, no kidding.
Males are smaller than females by about 25% and also don't live as long. They tend to die pretty quickly after mating with a female. They're just kind of mate with a female and then go, all right, I'm out. And this often means that there are more females than males in a population of mosquito fish at any one time. In terms of their habitats, they prefer standing water, but they can live pretty much anywhere and in a lot of different types of conditions and salinities, provided that the temperatures don't get too cold. Their range does have a northern limit because of this. Which is why they don't get too much further north than Illinois. Although they've been introduced further north and have sometimes been able to establish populations, but it's pretty uncommon.
I guess it's like certain microclimates they adjust well to.
Right. So like there are populations, like you mentioned here in Maryland, further north in and around Long Island and Cape Cod even, but those are very localized populations. They don't really spread the same way they do after they've been introduced in other areas like, you know, the Southwest or in California, right? Mm-hmm. Or on Hawaii or in the Pacific Islands, but I'm getting ahead of myself. As for the mosquito fish diet, they are extreme generalists. They feed on everything they can eat in a pond. Basically, if it fits in their mouth, they will try to eat it. Mostly this means that they eat zooplankton of various kinds, so really small little crustaceans, but they can also feed on algae. they're also ravenous hunters, and they will consume anywhere from 42 to 167% of their body weight in a day. I just want to take a minute and let that sink in.
They're hungry.
They're terrare hungry, my guy.
Don't leave your kids unattended.
Absolutely not. So, for comparison, the average human consumes about 3% of their body weight each day. These guys are on another order of magnitude from humans. Ultimately, their generalist nature and insatiable appetite means that there is a deplorable and yet completely predictable level of cannibalism in mosquito fish.
Just like Terrari.
Just like Terrari.
Allegedly. We can't prove it.
Okay. All right. But based on what we know about that guy, come on. He had to, at least by accident. For those who don't know, Terrari was an 18th century French peasant who was renowned for having an insatiable appetite and would and wanted to eat pretty much everything he came across, which allegedly included a human baby at one point.
Allegedly. We can't prove it.
Allegedly. Yes. That is unproven. But because mosquito fish have a generalist diet and will eat pretty much everything they come across in ponds, it means that mosquito fish will eat mosquito larvae. So, in theory, a mosquito fish can consume hundreds of mosquito larvae in a day. So, people throughout the 20th century treated this species as some kind of godsend because they would spread it all over the country from California to the Great Lakes and even as far north as Long Island and Cape Cod to control mosquito populations. Basically, they would dump mosquito fish in ponds or canals or waterways where they knew mosquitoes were breeding in the hopes that these fish would eat all the larvae and kill the population of mosquitoes. Not a bad idea, at least in theory. But this was such a popular thing to do that it continued not only throughout the United States, but throughout the world, really. In the 1920s and 1930s, mosquito fish were introduced in Japan, China, the Philippines, and New Zealand, in addition to a number of different Pacific islands. All of this done in the name of mosquito control, especially during World War II, when these areas were being occupied by Japanese and American troops. So, the obvious question is after introducing these fish into all these places, did it actually work in controlling mosquito populations?
They're called mosquito fish. So, I mean, they kind of live up to their name.
No, they don't. It did not work at all.
Okay.
Nope. While initially believed to curb mosquito populations by gobbling up their larvae, it turns out that they were gobbling up a lot more than just mosquito larvae. This included the larvae of other native fish species, which were either displaced by the mosquito fish or wiped out altogether. And as it turns out, some of these displaced fish species were actually more effective or specialized predators of mosquito larvae.
Oh my God, it made it worse.
Furthermore, the mosquito fish weren't just eating the mosquito larvae, they were eating all the other zooplankton and invertebrates in these habitats, which included the natural predators of mosquito larvae, as well as the other zooplankton with which they might compete. So effectively, the mosquito fish were removing the main predators of mosquito larvae and their main competitors, while also not feeding exclusively on the mosquito larvae. So they really didn't help anything at all.
They were a godsend for the mosquitoes.
Really? Well, I don't know if it actually increases or decreases the population of mosquito larvae. Evidence is inconclusive, but I'm pretty sure at this point that there's very little conclusive evidence that shows that introducing mosquito fish in an area reduces the breeding of mosquitoes.
Okay, so not only does it not really lower the mosquitoes population, but it just makes it worse for everything else.
Yes, it completely destroys a pond ecosystem. That's a really good segue. Because the mosquito fish eat the algal grazers in a pond, in particular Daphnia, which is a group of crustaceans. Once they eat all the grazers and the grazers are gone, the algae essentially gets free rein and it takes over the pond. Mosquito fish have been known to eat the algae itself, but that's not their preferred food. They much prefer crustaceans and other small fish. Thus, the introduction of mosquito fish has been known to be the main trigger for algal blooms, which can totally destroy a pond ecosystem, because all that algae grows all over the pond, eventually it decomposes, and that decomposition sucks all the oxygen out of the pond, and it doesn't get really get replenished very easily.
And something noteworthy is a lot of mosquito larvae actually have siphons, so that they don't actually breathe the oxygen in the pond.
Yes.
They're breathing air. So when that happens, it might not even affect them.
Right. So, essentially, mosquito fish can trigger eutrophication in a pond, which, as you just mentioned, will leave the mosquito larvae largely unaffected.
Okay, so we know it doesn't necessarily lower their population, but it removes their predators, or it lowers their predators, it lowers their competition, and creates an environment where the mosquitoes can handle fairly well, but everything else can't.
Correct.
I think it's safe to say they did not improve the situation.
That is very safe to say. We don't know that they made it. We don't know that they made the mosquito population worse, though.
I can't imagine how they couldn't at that point.
That's the tiniest of silver linings I have to offer you with this.
I guess it is a very widespread model to look at. I mean, when it's introduced, you got, how far were they spread?
Oh, all over the place. There are populations pretty much across the lower 48. And there was even a mass introduction in Hawaii in the 20th century on a lot of the major islands. So they're pretty much everywhere at this point. Again, populations tend to be isolated because of their lack of cold tolerance. So they can't go too far north. But, I mean, all across the southeast and the southwest at this point, there were a lot of introductions in California. And these have actually become a huge problem in Australia and New Zealand. They're a really, really major invasive species there. They're trying very hard to eradicate them, but I don't know if they can ever do that at this point. They're basically little demon fish, and they're also super aggressive, too. Like, they've been known to attack pretty much anything that comes near them. This includes larger fish, so they'll attack largemouth bass.
Like I said, we have it's not really a native bay tank anymore because A, we have these mosquito fish. It came from the bay. And then B, that there's like a mix up on an order where they send us the wrong fish. And it was like, well, what can I do with them? I can't send them back. So we got some killifish species that are native to further southeast. Doesn't matter. Loses the authenticity of the Chesapeake Bay biotope, I guess. But yeah, they are mean. I've seen them hound down on some of the other fish.
Yeah. Yeah, they're super aggressive, which is one of the reasons that they outcompete pretty much anything they come into contact with. And like I said, they can tolerate a wide range of salinities, too. They live in freshwater, brackish water, and saltwater. So they can thrive in estuaries, ponds, coastal areas. But knowing all this, what's really crazy is that although we know that mosquito fish don't really work to control mosquitoes, and that we also know that they're very, very disruptive to these ecosystems, people still sell them and advertise them as methods of mosquito control. When I was just researching this piece, I saw all kinds of listings on county websites that actually still encouraged people to spread mosquito fish around to reduce the spread of mosquito carry diseases. The scientific evidence on that fact is inconclusive at best. It's just this myth that has persisted.
All right. Well, to a point to that, have you ever heard of, I believe they're called mosquito eaters or mosquito killers? It is a common name, not a very popular one, for crane flies. Crane flies do not eat as an adult. They don't eat anything. Sometimes they can drink nectar. but I've seen people point to them and say, oh, that's a mosquito eater. You know, that'll take care of the mosquitoes for you. They don't eat at all. But again, it's a common name. If it sticks, if that's what it's called, people are going to assume.
Sure.
That's what it does.
Sure. It's pure wishful thinking. They want the fish to eat all the mosquito larvae, so that's what they think is happening.
So we got to give them a new name.
Yeah.
Like the pond busters. Something to make them unmarketable. It's like the opposite of when you rename a fish so that people eat it. Like how the orange roughy used to be called the slime head. We'll do the reverse with the mosquito fish.
Or like how they're trying to make the northern snakehead the Chesapeake Chana now.
The Chesapeake Chana, about that? Yeah. I have heard about that.
I don't think it's working. I think pretty much everyone realizes that that name is A, not very good, and B, it's just a substitute for snakehead.
Also, when you call it that, it implies that it's native, and it's not.
Yes. Yeah.
Not to mention, in the era of Google, someone's going to go, what is a Chesapeake Chana? I should look that up. Northern snakehead.
Right. It's actually from a different continent. Anyway. But yeah, the fact that people still think you can introduce mosquito fish to control mosquitoes is crazy at this point. And so it speaks to this idea that when we have a problem with a pest, we kind of tend to sometimes introduce organisms to control that pest that we don't fully understand, right? You've seen this countless times where you have an issue with mice, so you introduce snakes. This has happened on numerous different islands. So you introduce snakes, and well, yeah, snakes do eat mice, but they also eat birds. And bird eggs are a lot easier to catch than mice. So the snakes just eat all the bird eggs, and now all of a sudden you have lots of mice, lots of snakes, and no birds. So it's a really, really risky thing to introduce a second species to control an initial pest.
I think the only pushback to that is there's some research. I don't think it's been done yet, but there's always research going on in things like really specific parasites or parasitoid wasps, because in that case, they are like adapted to have a specific host. So this was proposed. I don't know if it actually ever happened, like with stink bugs. They're invasive in the U.S. There's proposition of some parasitoid wasp being used for them, because these wasps would almost exclusively target the stink bugs. That being said, you know, you really got to make sure that they only target the stink bugs.
Right, right. And that's the thing, is that you could never be 100% sure, even when you actually do all the research and look into the ecology of the species you're trying to introduce. There's always that small chance that it doesn't work out. And when it doesn't work out, like I said, it just makes things worse. So it's better to just try an alternate solution to the problem that you already have, you know? Otherwise, mm-hmm. You could just be going out of the frying pan and into the fire. So hopefully we find and properly test mosquito control that actually works and that doesn't obliterate aquatic ecosystems. So that's my piece on mosquito fish.
Really cool fish. Yeah, I actually...
Don't put them in your ponds.
Don't put them in your pond.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, well, I have some in a tank, but that's different. There's no intention for them to spread.
Right. I got no problem with that.
And to be fair, like, it was a native bay tank, was catching fish from the bay, and that's what I got.
Sure, sure. And like I said, you want to keep them in a tank? That's fine. You can keep fish in a tank. They're really easy to keep. They're hardy. As long as it doesn't get too cold in your house, you should be fine. But putting them in a pond.
Unless you're from the southeast, where that's where they're native, right?
That's true. In their native range, I guess that's fine. But
yeah.
Unless you're from that area, I wouldn't recommend it. All right. That's pretty much my piece. What have you got for me?
So in the past, I've talked a couple times about artificial habitats. You know, some good, some bad. Talked about the Korean DMZ, and we saw how this zone without any humans living it inadvertently became a great nature reserve.
Sure.
Likewise, there was also that power plant in Germany that accidentally created an environment fit for a lot of invasive tropical fish.
Right.
I'll discuss something similar today. In Hungary, there's a region known as the Pannonian Plain. It consists of a variety of wetlands, but the most interesting is the soda pans. So basically, there's a Coca-Cola plant that erupted into this one kind of divot, and it's just been really sticky there ever since.
Like the backseat of a minivan.
Oh my God, yes, backseat of a minivan. Oh, there's, you got McDonald's wrappers and lollipops, and every time you want to get off the seat, you got to chisel yourself. Now, a soda pan or a sodic meadow is a region with sodic water. So it is essentially high minerals like sodium carbonate, various hydrocarbons, etc. So it's more or less a sparkling water lake. These unique environments are pretty rare. Most of them are found in this region. They have lots of endemic and unique species. Researchers know that this particular area of the soda pans had high amounts of biodiversity in a series of about 120 small, close-together ponds. And the interesting thing about these ponds is they're the result of a mistargeted bombing from World War II.
Really?
Yep. So my topic today is going to be on bomb crater ponds and their effects on biodiversity.
Okay. I think I know when a lot of these were created.
Yeah, that's it's not hard to guess. So I'll focus on the ponds in Hungary at first, and then I'll kind of expand into other parts of the world, because believe it or not, there's been quite a few wars and lots of bomb crater ponds for sure.
I wonder how many of the ponds are sponsored by Uncle Sam.
It's up there.
Yeah.
they named the nature reserve after Lockheed Martin. I think with their in modern warfare now, I think after the bunker buster, they actually send like a tanker with some water and seaweed, you know, so they can claim it's an environmental thing. Get the hippies off their backs.
Yeah, it's a tax write-off for Northrop Grumman.
Oh my God, it probably is.
Anyways,
so in these specific sodic meadows, the ponds here were all likely from a bombing intended from a nearby airport that just missed its target.
Okay.
The actual history of these ponds is scarce, but of course, with time, plants and wildlife began to reclaim these holes as they were filled with water.
Life finds a way.
Life does indeed find a way. The ponds were found to be host to a number of plants, algae, fairy shrimp, which is, you know, close relatives of the sea monkeys.
Ah, old friends of the show.
Yeah, old friends of the show. And other invertebrates like dragonflies, mayflies, beetles, and more.
Okay.
So I read through two studies on these sodic bomb crater ponds, both of which came to similar conclusions, and they're both actually fairly recent discoveries as well. The first paper was in 2017, and it sought to assess the biodiversity of these ponds. Most of these were small. They're about 3 to 12 meters in diameter, so about 9 to 40 feet, and 40 centimeters deep, so about a foot deep.
So these ponds were initially created after bombings during various wars.
These were all World War II.
World War II, okay. And then they were made like soda after, you said a Coke plant exploded?
Oh, that was a joke. I thought that was clear. No, the region, it's called a sodic plain. The water is just naturally high in minerals.
Okay,
like soda water.
Yeah, your delivery of that might have been a bit too deadpan.
Okay, yeah, that's on me.
Anyway.
My bad, y'all. No, there was no Coca-Cola plant involved.
I was about to show this recording to my dentist, like, see? Something can live in soda. So it's all right if I drink it.
No, it's very alkaline. It's high in minerals, hydrocarbons. I don't think it's really like bubbly per se, but yeah. So it's a unique environment for sure. So another thing about these ponds is they only hold water for part of the year. Some of the bigger ones holding water for, you know, a couple months, and the smaller ones maybe only a few weeks. So they're similar to vernal pools in the United States if you just added a lot of baking soda to them. So they sampled the ponds for wildlife and assessed the data. Most ponds were filled with reeds and sedges, along with the wildlife I mentioned earlier. And they found that the ponds contained a rare or protected species from every different taxon they looked at. Really? So essentially, of all the turtles they found, at least one of them was rare or protected. Of all the frogs, same thing. Every single group of invertebrates, etc. The smaller bomb crater ponds had just as much diversity as the natural occurring water bodies in the area.
Really? So these bombed out Perrier ponds became havens of biodiversity?
Hey, life finds a way. You said it, not me.
Wow. All right, cool.
Yeah, it is cool. And what is one of the reasons why it works well in this specific environment is because much of the wildlife in this region is used to a rapidly changing environment. As I mentioned, these are temporary pools, so these regions are subject to flooding and drying out frequently. And it's also alkaline water, so it's, you know, on the basic side of things. So a lot of the wildlife is kind of used to these fluctuating conditions. So it seems to be relatively easy for plants and animals to just adjust to these bomb crater ponds. I mean, basically just get a big hole, some water fills in, and then from there, life just works its way in. Also worth noting that ponds and wetlands across Europe are being destroyed at an alarming rate. So this miscalculated bombing was actually doing a lot of good for the wildlife in this region.
Hey, I guess we get something right accidentally every now and then.
Yeah. You know, broken clock, right twice a day, that sort of thing.
Sure, sure.
And of course, of the species they found, there was algae found only in this environment, endangered dragonflies, the fairy shrimps I mentioned, which are a crucial component to this ecosystem, beetles, true bugs of the hemipteran family, like water bugs, flies, frogs, newts, oh, and the beloved firebelly toad, and turtles.
Hmm. Awesome.
Yep. The second study found similar results, but it kind of built off of their findings a bit more. So, of course, it also concluded, hey, there's a lot of diversity in these ponds. But expand on why these ponds were important and, you know, why there was diversity in these ponds. So the ponds, of course, are from a cluster of bombs that are all fairly close together. They're over 50 in a square kilometer, so packed in pretty tight. We can look at them as a single pondscape rather than a series of individual ponds. And this is great because a lot of the animals in these ponds have limits to their dispersal. So obviously, a frog can hop to a new pond. Same for a turtle that can walk or dragonfly can fly away. But animals like fairy shrimp, algae, or other small aquatic invertebrates like Daphnia, they can't do that. They have to stay in the water.
Sure.
So they rely on environmental conditions for dispersal. This could be winds or flooding, depending on the species. And it's also worth noting that even the adult forms of a lot of these insects can be so small and crappy at flying that they can't even really go that far. Just because a fly has wings does not mean they're good at flying. They might just be built to breed and die. Like, that is it. They're not doing much else. So when you have a cluster of these ponds together, it allows for a better chance of dispersal. So you get more biodiversity from a cluster of ponds in an open area than you would in the same amount spread across the country. So you can think of it, in other words, the importance of these ponds is about their interconnectivity, not necessarily their individual existence. I guess if you had the bomb in area, best to cluster the smaller bombs as best as you can, and for the sake of biodiversity.
I'm sure that's a really top consideration on a lot of bombing runs.
Yeah. Other thing you can think of is if you have a lot of these ponds close together and there is some sort of, I don't know, disaster in one of them, like algae bloom in one of the ponds, system is nuked, everything dies off. If you have nearby ponds, they can easily sort of reseed that pond. It's much easier to happen. So they could potentially bounce back from disturbances quickly, because the wildlife can just migrate to it.
All right, so if somebody thought they wanted to control mosquito populations and dumped a whole bunch of a certain type of fish in that pond, then it could potentially recover?
Well, in this case, I believe it would, because these ponds tend to dry out.
Ah, Okay.
To my knowledge, there are no fish native to these ponds. Maybe there's a killifish species, but I didn't read about any of it.
Okay. Gotcha.
It's very similar environments to, like I said, the vernal pools in the United States, where you have a lot of insects and amphibians and reptiles.
Sure.
And oh, there's all sorts of crustaceans too, but they're all adapted to, part of their life cycle is the pond will dry up. You know, they got to deal with that. Either lay eggs, go dormant, or die. And that is about it in terms of these ponds of Hungary. In Hungary, of course, this particular area is studied due to its unique location. I imagine convenience as well, because it's right by an airport. So it's not like you have to
cross
the country to get to it.
Wait, you said it's right by an airport?
I don't know how close it is to an airport, but the bombing run was believed to be intended for the airport. So I'm assuming it's within a mile or two. But of course, there are a couple other papers I found. I found a short paper from the 90s where they examined bomb crater ponds from the Indo-Chinese conflict in Laos. Of all the bomb crater pond samples, 90% of them contain tadpoles for various frog species. And some of the ponds actually contain fish, eels, prawns, snails, and other fully aquatic animals. Fully aquatic animals, not ones that can migrate on land.
Cool.
This likely arrived from seasonal flooding. Some of these ponds were so stocked that the local villages relied upon them for food by simply throwing cast nets into the water.
Really?
It was noted that it's possible some of these ponds may have actually been stocked with fish after the bombing, but that doesn't account for all the other various aquatic animals that lived in them. And then I found another paper from 1949 in England and discussed another series of bomb crater ponds in Buckinghamshire, which had been colonized by a variety of aquatic snails, fish, and crustaceans. I could not access the full paper, but the fact that it was in 1949, so, you know, just 5 to 10 years after the initial bombing, suggests it was a fairly quick turnover. Yeah. So that is all I got on the topic. There are a couple other examples out there. If you look up bomb crater pond, especially if you're in Europe, you'll find a lot of smaller local results. Like, I'm sure every country has at least one. I mean, I found just looking around on Google Maps. Most of them are not like properly studied. It was these ones in Hungary that were really noteworthy because it was a unique environment and they were able to see how these bomb crater ponds actually provided like a great refuge. It was basically as good as the naturally occurring wetlands.
Okay. Do we have any of these types of ponds here in the United States?
So I didn't look into that. I am leaning towards no, because we haven't had any major conflicts with, like, I don't know how to put it, noteworthy explosives.
We haven't had any major conflicts on U.S. soil in, what, about 150 years? Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, there were explosive use then, but it was nothing compared to, you know, the bombing runs of the 1900s.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely not. Definitely not.
So I don't know if cannonballs, or maybe there's like a big keg of TNT used at some point. Or you know what? There's probably just some guy blowing them up in his backyard.
Hey, Jimmy, why are all these ponds in your backyard? Oh, it's a science experiment. I'm researching pond ecology.
Just lobs a stick of dynamite over.
Right. Yeah, there's don't worry about all those fuses in the corner. They're not attached to anything. It's fine.
That one's for the tadpoles.
Right. It's I'm weaving a net.
Yeah. All right. And that's my piece.
That was really cool. Yeah, I guess I never really wondered or never thought about what happened to all the areas that were affected by bombs from World War I and World War II.
So something I wondered, I didn't find anything that touched on this, was like heavy metal poisoning, you know, what leaches out from the bombings. In the case of Hungary, doesn't seem to be an issue, but a lot of the wildlife in this region is kind of well adjusted to extreme conditions. So I don't know how it would be across the board. Also worth noting, I didn't find many papers on a Google Scholar search. I find these two big ones that I mentioned and a couple smaller ones, but that was really it. And there's been quite a few bombings in recent history. So I feel like there should be more of these ponds out there.
Oh, yeah, there definitely are. But I think, like you were alluding to, they're not necessarily well studied.
Yeah. Might not be much of an incentive to study them.
Right. Right. But who knows? Maybe we find a few others that are near major airports that are easy to research. All right, cool. What are you thinking about for the next episode then?
Well, the next episode will be coming out on the 24th of October.
Hell yeah. Halloween episode?
I think it has to be. No, sorry. It'll be coming out on... No, the 31st. Oh, it comes out on Halloween exact.
Hell yeah.
There
Halloween episode?
Halloween episode.
Awesome. All right. Well, stay tuned for that one. And with that decided, Aaron, you want to take us out?
Yep. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a follow or review on your podcast app of choice. And if you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at SoupPotPodcast on Twitter or theprimordialsoupot@gmail.com.
Sounds good. Till next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.